Hello, everybody. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now in 1 Samuel chapter 9. I'm going to do all 27 verses of the chapter, and we will see in this chapter Saul chosen to be king and anointed by Samuel. Our context is this, and the previous chapter, chapter 8, Israel demanded a king. They wanted somebody to fight for them, and they wanted somebody to give them law and order. This was displeasing to God and displeasing to Samuel because they were afraid, or Samuel was afraid, that the people's desire for a king would place a human king on the throne, which would displace God as king in the eyes of the Israelites. But nonetheless, God decided to give them what they wanted and said, it's going to be bad. The king is going to tax you to death, and he's going to put your sons in the army, and they're going to get killed. But if you want a king, I'm going to give you one. So he told Samuel to give him a king. So now here's the story of how Israel got their first king. 1 Samuel 9, verses 1 and 2. Now there was a man of Benjamin whose name was Kish, the son of Abiel, the son of Zeror, the son of Bechoroth, the son of Aphiah, the son of a Benjamite, a mighty man of valor. He had a son whose name was Saul, a choice and handsome man. And there was not a more handsome person than he among the sons of Israel. From his shoulders and up, he was taller than any of the people. Now, it's interesting that Saul's father, whose name was Kish, that Saul's father had a name that meant ensnared. He was ensnared. I don't know what that means exactly, but I can't imagine why a parent would name his child ensnared. But there you have it. Now, a little harmony problem here. Kish is said to be the son of Abiel, but First Chronicles has Kish as the son of Ner. So who's the father of Kish? Is it Ner or Abiel? This is not a big problem of momentous theological importance, but let's just try to solve it here. First option to solve the problem is Ner is not really the father of Kish in First Chronicles. He's the begetter or the bringer up of Kish, as Gil says. If you'll read First Chronicles, it says that Ner begat Kish. Well, you interpret that as meaning Ner raised up Kish because his father Abiel had died. Ner and Kish's, who were brothers, their father died, and so Ner brought up Kish. That's one way to reconcile it. Another way, according to John Gill and Colin Dillett, says that there are two Ners. We have Abiel has Ner, and then Ner had Ner Jr. and Kish, and then Ner Jr. had Abner, the future general, and Kish had Saul. So Kish is therefore the descendant, not the son, directly the son of Abiel, but the descendant of Abiel. As you mess with genealogies enough, you realize that when it says father, it could mean ancestor. When it's son, it can mean descendant, because a lot of times the genealogies are collapsed. It's a minor problem. Verse 1, this Kish is said to be a mighty man of valor. Now here I've got two commentators who directly contradict each other, Gill and Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown. Gill says that this mighty man Kish was not a man of riches or of authority, neither a wealthy man nor a magistrate, for his family was mean and contemptible, but a man of great strength, an able-bodied man, and of great natural fortitude and courage of mind. So John Gill says that Kish was not socially prominent or politically prominent or culturally prominent in his hometown, but he was a he-man. He was a man of great strength. Now, the scriptures that Gill used to support that, 1 Samuel 9:21, Saul responded, "Am I not a Benjaminite from the smallest of Israel's tribes, and isn't my clan the least important of all the clans of the Benjaminite tribe? So why have you said something like this to me?" And 1 Samuel 10:27, but some wicked men said, "How can this guy save us?" Referring to Saul. They despised him and did not bring him a gift, but Saul said nothing. And so Gill says these verses show that the Benjaminites were pathetic, Saul was pathetic, and so therefore Kish was pathetic, but he had big muscles. Well, against that view is Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown, who say that Kish was a man of great wealth and substance. The family was of high consideration in the tribe of Benjamin, and therefore Saul's words must be set down among the common forms of affected humility, which Oriental people are wont to use. In other words, Gill is wrong to take Saul at face value in 1 Samuel 9:21 when Saul responded, "I'm from the smallest of Israel's tribes. I'm from the least important tribe." That's just humility. It doesn't really mean anything. Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown says that Kish was of great wealth and substance, and we can prove that. I don't think Jameson Fawcett Brown used these verses to show it, but I've noticed in 1 Samuel 9:3, one day the donkeys of Saul's father Kish wandered off. Kish said to his son Saul, "Take one of the attendants with you and go look for the donkeys." Only rich people have servants and donkeys. Donkeys were a sign of wealth, and if you got an attendant, that means a slave or a servant. Could be a slave. Whether it's a servant or a slave, it doesn't make any difference. The fact is, poor people don't have servants or slaves. So we're going to assume that Gil doesn't know what he's talking about, and Jameson Fawcett and Brown are right, and that Kish was a prominent member of society. His son Saul was handsome and taller than any of the people. He was the tallest of all of the Benjaminites back then. It's interesting that Saul's physical characteristics are emphasized here. And Adam Clark says this, where kings were elective in all ancient times, great respect was paid to personal appearance. And that's true. I mean, even in modern presidential politics, they say somebody short doesn't have a chance. They stand them up on blocks, hope people don't notice. I remember Howard Baker was running for president years ago. He was the Republican leader of the Senate, and he was shorter than 6 feet. And he lost, but of course, it might not be because he was short, but it sure didn't help him any. Well, Saul might have been handsome and tall. He might have had great physical qualities, but his subsequent history doesn't say too much for his moral qualities, as, of course, we'll find out as we go through his history. We go now to 1 Samuel 9, verses 3 and 4. Now the donkeys of Kish, Saul's father, were lost. So Kish said to his son Saul, "Take now with you one of the servants and arise, go search for the donkeys." He passed through the hill country of Ephraim and passed through the land of Shalishah. But they did not find them. Then they passed through the land of Shalim, but they were not there. Then he passed through the land of the Benjaminites, but they did not find them. Now, how do you lose donkeys? Here's what Jameson Fawcett Brown says about that. Quote, Kish, according to the immemorial usage of Oriental shepherds and the purely pastoral regions, had let the animals roam at large during the grazing season, at the close of which messengers were dispatched in search of them. That makes a lot of sense. You just let them, they didn't have fencing back then, so they just let them roam. Now, why did Kish choose his son Saul to go look for the donkeys instead of a servant? Well, a son is more likely to search hard for the wandering asses than a servant would, so Saul's chosen. In fact, Saul has servants to go, one servant to go with him on this hunt, because Saul needed somebody to help him, somebody to wait on him, perhaps. Again, I'm assuming that Saul was not a poor guy and his father was not poor. He was fairly wealthy. Now Saul, in verse 4, passed through the hill country of Ephraim. That's that range of hills that goes starts right north of Jerusalem. The land of Benjamin goes all the way up to Manasseh, right through the center, vertical center of Israel. Now, since we're talking about geography here, I want to say this concerning the geography of where Saul went to search for those donkeys. It really doesn't matter for the story, but I'm curious. And I looked up in the commentators, and they're very speculative and very contradictory, and I don't have any idea for sure where Saul went, but my deductions from reading the commentaries is this. There's two optional routes that you can choose for Saul's correct route. One is a long route that Saul went all the way from his hometown of Gibeah, which is right north of Jerusalem in Benjamin. He went all the way from Gibeah all the way up past Samuel's hometown of Ramathaim Zophim, which if you look at the map is about 20 miles or so up to the northwest, or he could have been on a short route from Gibeah, which is right north of Jerusalem, to Gibeon, which is 5 miles northwest of Jerusalem, just a few miles further, and Ramah is just a few miles to the northeast of Gibeon. So if you look at it this way from left to right and think of a tent with Ramah at the apex of the tent, Gibeon at the bottom left corner and Gibeah at the bottom right corner. You see these three towns right, three or 4 miles north of Jerusalem. So that's the area that he was looking for those sheep. And I think that makes a lot of sense. I could be wrong. Now, some of these towns that are mentioned that Benjamin went through, one was Shalishah. Great name, Shalishah. Well, Easton's puts that about 12 miles north of Lydda. Lydda's about 10 miles inland from Joppa on the coast, and that's a good ways away from Gibeon, the short route that I just mentioned. So Easton's would have the long route. BibleAtlas.org has Shalishah right with the pin right on top of Gibeon. So it's either synonymous with Gibeon or in the close vicinity of Gibeon. BibleAtlas.org also does the same thing for Shalim, so they have a short route for Saul going to look for those donkeys. Easton's for Shalim in verse 4 says that Shalim is land of foxes, a place apparently to the northwest of Jerusalem. Well, who knows where that is? Again, BibleAtlas.org has that close to Gibeon. So we're going to assume it's all right around there in Benjamin, near Gibeon, Ramah, Gibeah. That's what we're talking about now. Could be wrong. 1 Samuel 9, verses 5 through 6, when they came to the land of Zuf, Saul said to his servant who was with him, "Come and let us return, or else my father will cease to be concerned about the donkeys and will become anxious for us." He said to him, "Behold, now there is a man of God in this city, and the man is held in honor, and all that he says surely comes true. Now let us go there. Perhaps he can tell us about our journey on which we have set out." So this city that's not mentioned by Saul is said to be in verse 5 in the land of Zuf. Well, the question is what is that? Well, one place it could be is Samuel's hometown of Ramathaim Zophim, or Ramathaim of Zuf. Zuf means honeycomb. Now that was a good bit a ways up to the northwest, over 20 miles or so. It was Samuel's hometown where he was born. That's one option. That's the option that John Gill and Matthew Poole take. But note that there are other people who think that it's not Samuel's hometown of Ramathaim Zophim, but that it was the other Ramah, which is just north of Jerusalem, on the road north out of Jerusalem, out of the city, where Rachel famously died in childbirth, giving birth to Benjamin. Here's what Jameson Fawcett Brown say. Ramah was the usual residence of Samuel, talking about Ramathaim Zophim, but several circumstances, especially the mention of Rachel's sepulcher, which lay in Saul's way homeward, that's in our next chapter, 1 Samuel 10:2, is going to mention Rachel's tomb. That mention of Rachel's tomb leads to the conclusion that the city was not Ramathaim Zophim, where Samuel was born and raised and was living, but Jameson Fawcett Brown says it's the other Ramah, where Rachel died. Here's what BibleStudyTools.com says. The land of Zuf, quote, evidently contained the city in which they, Saul and his servants, encountered Samuel, verse 6, and that again was certainly not far from the tomb of Rachel. They were very certain about it. It's not Samuel's hometown. It's Ramah, Rachel's Ramah, I call it. And another fact which tends to make you think that it's possible that it's Rachel's Ramah that's being talked about and not Samuel's hometown is the fact that Ramah was two or three miles south of Mizpah, and Mizpah was on Samuel's judging circuit, the circuit he went on in order to judge the Israelites in 1 Samuel 7:16. Every year he would go on a circuit to Bethel, Gilgal, and Mizpah and would judge Israel at all these locations, and Ramah's just a hop, skip, and a jump south of Mizpah. So I'm going to assume that this is Rachel's Ramah. Again, this is speculative. I could be wrong. But I'm going to assume, just for the sake of argument, this is where Samuel is, and this is where Saul goes to see Samuel. Now, this man of God that Saul tells his servant about, he calls him a man of God. That's the typical name for a prophet. He's referring to Samuel. And one might ask, why would you go to a prophet to look for some lost asses? Isn't that a little mundane for a prophet? Well, but we got to remember something. These asses were worth a lot of money. To us, they're just donkeys, okay? But back then, it was a symbol of wealth. They were wealthy. They were valuable. People that owned them did not want to lose them. So, and plus, Saul had been sent out by his father. He didn't want to come home and disappoint his father. So to him, it was a big deal. Now, Saul knew about Samuel's reputation. He told his servant, "Hey, everything this man says surely comes true." Well, that actually fulfills the scripture. Fulfills what God said about Samuel. 1 Samuel 3:12, 13, and 14, 18, and 19. I'll read that. "On that day, I, Yahweh, will carry out against Eli everything I said about his family." Yahweh's talking to Samuel. "From beginning to end, I told him that I'm going to judge his family forever because of the iniquity he knows about. His sons are defiling the sanctuary, and he has not stopped them. Therefore, I have sworn to Eli's family, the iniquity of Eli's family will never be wiped out by either sacrifice or offering." Basically, God's telling Samuel what to tell Eli, and Eli did it. Verse 18, "So Samuel told him everything, told Eli everything. He did not hide anything from him. Samuel grew, and the Lord was with him, and he fulfilled everything." He, Yahweh, fulfilled everything Samuel prophesied. So Samuel was one of these prophets that didn't miss. He was right all the time, and Saul had heard of his reputation. We go down to 1 Samuel 9, verses 7 through 9. Then Saul said to his servant, But behold, if we go, what shall we bring the man? For the bread is gone from our sack, and there is no present to bring to the man of God. What do we have? The servant answered Saul again and said, Behold, I have in my hand a fourth of a shekel of silver. I will give it to the man of God, and he will tell us our way. Here's a parenthetical note in verse 9. Formerly in Israel, when a man went to inquire of God, he used to say, Come and let us go to the seer. For he was called a prophet now, was formerly called a seer. Now in verse 7, Saul's looking for something to bring to Samuel. And that was in accordance with the custom back then to bring prophets' presents before inquiring of them, because a prophet needed to be supported. Now I will say this. That comes awful close to bribing people, to paying people, to a pay-to-pray type of situation where you pay for a prophecy. And I'm real suspicious of that sort of thing, but that's the way they did things back then. And let's look at some scriptures to show that. 1 Kings 14, 2 through 3. Jeroboam said to his wife, Arise now and disguise yourself so that they will not know that you are the wife of Jeroboam, and go to Shiloh. Behold, Ahijah the prophet is there, who spoke concerning me that I would be king over this people. Take 10 loaves with you, some cakes and a jar of honey, and go to him. So there you go. There's presents from Jeroboam to Ahijah the prophet. Here's 2 Kings 4:42. Now a man came from Baal Shalisha and brought the man of God, referring to Elisha, brought the man of God bread of the first fruits, 20 loaves of barley and fresh ears of grain in his sack. So there's again presents for the prophets. And actually, it was an invariable custom in the ancient Near East that no one approached a superior without a gift, not just a prophet, but a lord or a king. So we shouldn't interpret this as saying that prophets were in the custom of taking bribes. That's not true. Now, the servant had in his hand a fourth of a shekel of silver. That's not a lot. The NIV Study Bible note says it's about one-tenth of an ounce, about 3 grams. The Holman Christian Study Bible doesn't even translate it with an amount. They just say a piece of silver, so it's a little tiny bit. But of course, Samuel's not worried about how big the present is. 3 grains of silver is enough for him, because God had told him, King's coming in here tomorrow, so get ready for him. Now, once again, I'll mention this fact about Saul wanting to find out about asses. Some people have said that shows that Saul must have had a low opinion of prophets to think that they would give answers for mundane things like that. But remember, those donkeys were very valuable to Saul and to Saul's father, so it wasn't so mundane to him. Now, the parenthetical note in verse 9, formerly in Israel, when a man went to inquire of God, he used to say, Come and let us go to the seer, S-E-E-R, the seer, for who is called a prophet now was formerly called a seer. So in the olden days, you called a prophet a seer, or you called these people who spoke the word of God a seer, and then in the latter days, you call them a prophet. Now, there's two ways to look at that. And before I go into them, it reminds me, I sat in a Reformed Theological Seminary in Atlanta class, and the professor just happened to be going through the Old Testament, and he mentioned the distinction between seer and prophet. I remember the Navi was the prophet, and the seer was the roar or something. I can't remember the Hebrew. But he was making a big deal out of this, and I remember thinking, I don't understand what he's saying, but one day I'm going to try to figure out what the difference is between a seer and a prophet. Well, here I am, and after searching on the internet and after reading through a bunch of commentaries, I've come up with two options as to how you can interpret the difference between a seer and a prophet. Option number one, there ain't no difference. Option number two, a seer is a special kind of prophet. Well, let's look at option number one that says there's no difference. Basically, what you're saying is there's simply two different words for the same thing. You can call them a seer and call them a prophet, but things are, you know, language changes. I've learned this studying Chinese, or just in English. Words change. It used to be try to contact somebody. Now it's reach out to somebody. I'm old enough to have seen all kinds of language changes in English, and I saw it even in China. In the 20-something years I was in China, I remember one time I had 3 Chinese lessons. One was taught by somebody my age, one was taught somebody 20 years younger than me, and one was taught by a young college student. And I would learn a new Chinese word from the college student, ask the middle-aged person. They didn't know what it was. I asked the older person. They didn't know what it was. Never heard the Chinese word because the language was changing. So that's the first option. There's just no difference between the two words. The two words meaning the same thing. John Gill holds this view. He says, for though these names are used freely of the same persons, both before and after this time, yet now the more common appellation which obtained was that of a prophet. Custom and the use of language varied at different times. Though the same was meant by the one and the other, such men were called seers. That's just a fancy way of saying what I just said. There's no difference. But now other people say that a seer is a special kind of prophet. A seer sees visions and symbols, whereas a prophet might merely receive the words of a prophecy. So all seers are prophets. They tell forth the word of God to people, but not all prophets are seers, because some people who tell forth the word of God don't see the symbols and the pictures. Now let me read you some commentators agreeing with that view. Adam Clark says, a seer and a prophet were the same in most cases, only with this difference. The seer was always a prophet, but the prophet was not always a seer. A seer seems to imply one who frequently met with and saw some symbolical representation of God. The term prophet was used a long time before this. Abraham is called a prophet, and the term frequently occurs in the law. Besides, the word seer does not occur before this time, but often occurs down through the prophets for more than 300 years. Well, let me say here, Clark is saying that the only difference is that a seer, when he speaks forth the words of God, he sees a vision, a symbol. Clark also mentions here that the distinction is not absolute, that you can find the word prophet used before Samuel's time, and you can find the word seer used after Samuel's time. This is just a general statement that's being made here in the book of Samuel. Jameson Fawcett and Brown says this, the recognized distinction in latter times was that a seer was one who was favored with visions of God, a view of things invisible to mortal sight, and a prophet foretold future events. So you can foretell a future event by having by seeing a vision or a physical symbol, not a physical symbol, but a thing that you see, an object that you see, or you could just foretell the future with words. If you did the latter, you were a prophet. If you did the former, you were a seer. And think about the word seer. It means one who sees, a seer, a seer. Well, to me, that's a distinction that doesn't mean a hill of beans of difference, but it is kind of interesting since it's mentioned here in verse 9, and since it was important enough to be brought up in a seminary class, so I figured we better look at it a little bit. Now, this word formerly, a prophet now was formerly called a seer. Some people take that as an argument against Samuel writing the book, because there has to be enough time passing from the time of the story here, which Samuel is in, to the time that the language shifted from seer to prophet. And so that time is such a long time, it is argued, therefore, it must be a different person writing the book rather than Samuel. However, you could say Samuel was real old when he wrote the book, and that was old enough for the language to change. I mean, I'm old, and English has changed in my lifetime, so that could have happened too. So I'm not sure that argument is conclusive either way about who wrote the book. We go now to 1 Samuel verses 10 through 13. Then Saul said to his servant, well said, come, let us go. What was well said? Well, what was well said was the servant said, I'll give him 3 grains of silver, a piece of silver. Saul said, that's good, we'll go. So they went to the city where the man of God was. And again, that city, I'm going to take it here as Rachel's Ramah, the one that's right north of Jerusalem, where the man of God was. As they went up the slope to the city, they found young women going out to draw water and said to them, is the seer here? They answered them and said, he is. See, he is ahead of you. Hurry now, for he has come into the city today, for the people have a sacrifice on the high place today. As soon as you enter the city, you will find him before he goes up to the high place to eat. For the people will not eat until he comes, because he must bless the sacrifice. Afterward, those who are invited will eat. Now therefore, go up for you. Therefore, go up, for you will find him at once. Now, there's a slope mentioned in verse 11. They went up the slope, Saul and his servant. That's appropriate. Ramah means high and lifted up. That's what the Hebrew means, according to John Gill. Saul and his servant found young women coming out of the city to draw water. Now, this is an interesting point that John Gill makes. Whenever a man met women coming out of a city before the man went into the city, this was a sign of prosperity. We see this in Genesis 24:14, when Abraham's servant's going to look for a wife for Isaac, came up with Rebekah, if you recall, when he went to Haran in Syria. Now may it be that the girl to whom I, Abraham's servant, say, please let down your jar so that I may drink, and who answers, drink, and I will water your camels also, may she be the one whom you have appointed for your servant Isaac. And by this I will know that you have shown loving kindness to my master. And we know the story. Rebekah comes out. And Abraham's servant says, "Hot dog, I found a wife for my master Isaac." Good news when a woman comes out of the city. Here's some more good news for that's indicated by a woman coming out of the city. That's when Jacob went to look for a wife. Genesis 29, 10 through 11, when Jacob saw Rachel, the daughter of Laban, his mother's brother, and the sheep of Laban, his mother's brother, Jacob went up and rolled the stone from the mouth of the well and watered the flock. This, again, was the well outside the city. Rachel comes out. Jacob meets Rachel. Good things happen. The patriarchs of Israel are born. Jacob kissed Rachel, lifted up his voice, and wept. Kind of interesting. Well, good things are about to happen here, too. Saul's about to be named king. Now, he's going in there looking for asses. He's going to come out king. It was quite a shock, I'm sure. Now, Samuel had been somewhere, and he'd come into the city that day, into Ramah. Where did he come in from? He could have come in from riding his circuit of judges, carrying out his judicial activities. Some people say, nah, he was too old for that. Well, he'd appointed his sons already, and the sons were doing it down in Beersheba in the previous chapter. But no, he could have been judging contemporaneously with his sons. So I don't think that's a strong argument. So, and the circuit, as I said, Mizpah's right just a couple miles north of Ramah. So, or if you take the Ramah as being Ramathaim Zophim, Samuel's hometown, he could have been coming into his hometown from a place called Naioth, N-A-I-O-T-H, where there was probably a school of prophets. We'll see that when we get to 1 Samuel 19. But I don't take the place of this anointing of Saul as Ramathaim Zophim. I think it's Rachel's Ramah. He could have come into Rachel's Ramah coming in from his hometown, Ramathaim Zophim. For whatever reason, it doesn't matter. He shows up in the city that day. And the day that he shows up, the people have a sacrifice planned on the high place today. Well, this sacrifice had probably been arranged by Samuel. He knew that a king was going to be anointed today, and that's why they were having a sacrifice. And he probably expected it to be especially festive, because when a king is anointed, that's a big deal. It was on a high place. Ramah means high and lifted up. This is the highest part of Ramah. This is really way up there at the top of the environs. It was perfectly legal. Most high places you think of idols being there. But remember, Shiloh was destroyed. Probably the tent of meeting was destroyed also. The ark was down in Kiriath-Jearim. So there was no tabernacle anywhere. So it was okay to have a high place there. And Samuel was sort of acting like a priest. He wasn't a priest, but things are loose now. Things are not quite as Levitically kosher as they are going to be when things are set up in Jerusalem as they were when the tabernacle was in Shiloh. Now the women told Saul and his servant that you will meet Samuel as soon as you enter into the city. Verse 13, that means that Samuel's house was probably at the end of the city where Saul approached to and entered through. First thing he meets is Samuel. Now the girls probably wanted Saul and his servant to meet Saul quickly because they knew that Saul and his servant wouldn't get a chance to talk with Samuel once the meal had started. Now notice the women were certain that as soon as Saul and his servant entered the city, they will find Saul. She doesn't mention, or they don't mention, the women don't mention any distinctive dress that Samuel might be wearing. Samuel was not dressed high and mighty. He wore normal clothes that everyone else did. So those young women must have known that Samuel lived at that end of the city that Saul was going into, Saul and his servant were entering. Now, verse 13, well, the women in verse 13 point out to Saul, this sacrifice is going to be held up until Samuel gets there because he's got to bless the sacrifice. Again, it sounds like sacrifice sounds like Samuel's sacrifice, and maybe somebody else is doing it, but at any rate, says after Samuel gets there, those who are invited will eat. Who are invited to eat? Well, we'll see in just a minute. There were 30 men invited to eat. I assume they were elders of the city. And this sacrifice is probably a peace offering. And remember, with peace offering, the priest offers the fat up to God, the breast to the officiating priest, and the right foreleg to the officiating to the priest. If my memory serves me correctly, the breast went to the priest in general, the right foreleg went to the officiating priest, and the rest of the animal went to the people who were invited to the feast, the family of the offeror, the friends of the offeror, the poor, the fatherless, strangers, Levites, anybody could be invited to a peace offering. So this was a big peace offering festival, probably. We go now to 1 Samuel 9, verses 14 through 16. So they went up to the city, that's Saul and his servant. They came into the city. Behold, Samuel was coming out toward them to go up to the high place. Now, a day before Saul's coming, the Lord had revealed this to Samuel, saying, "About this time tomorrow I will send you a man from the land of Benjamin, and you shall anoint him to be prince over my people Israel, and he will deliver my people from the hand of the Philistines. For I have regarded my people, because their cry has come to me." That's really nice of the Lord to say that to Samuel, because remember, the Lord was not happy with this desire for a king. But God answers their prayers, and he says, and that was why the Israelites wanted a king, was to stop the Philistines, one of the reasons. And God says, okay, they want deliverance, I'm going to deliver them. I'm not really happy about what they're doing here, but I'm not going to leave them in the lurch. So Saul and the servant came into the city. That means they came into the walls of the city. They saw Samuel coming toward them. Now, that might have been by chance, but remember, God had revealed to Samuel that the new king was on his way, and about this time tomorrow, a man's going to come into the gate. So Samuel probably, this was not by chance, Samuel, in response to the prophetic word of the Lord, went to where the gate was, to where the king would probably be coming in, and there he was. Now, this had to be prophetic. It had to be miraculous. Saul's just a kid. Well, he was tall and handsome. I guess he might have looked like a king, but still, just to, I don't think Saul knew Samuel. Excuse me, that Samuel knew Saul. And so that's taking a big chance to anoint somebody that's king over all Israel, whose previous occupation was looking after asses. I'm tempted to say something about modern political leaders, but I won't. So this has to be a word from God to get Samuel chosen. And now what a shock this was going to be for this man who is looking for asses and instead finds a kingdom. God told Samuel to anoint him. Of course, that's what you do to kings. Anoint him to be a prince. The Hebrew is Nagid, and if I pronounce that right, N-A-G-I-D, which means captain of the Lord's host, of the Lord's army, the Israelites, the Israelite army. Prince over the Israelites. They will deliver my people from the hand of the Philistines. John Gill says the Philistines had done a lot of bad stuff to Israel. Since Samuel had grown old, the Philistines had made encroachments upon the Israelites. Remember, when Samuel was young at the Battle of Mizpah, when the Israelites repented like crazy, and then all of a sudden the Philistines attacked them, and then the Israelites went and wiped the Philistines out. Well, since then, according to John Gill, I think he's right, the Philistines had made encroachments upon the Israelites. They had built garrisons on the Israelites' borders. They had made, it as very probable, incursions upon the Israelites and ravages and oppressions of them. One more reason the Israelites were so hot to have a king, despite the fact that they had beat the Philistines before at Mizpah without having a king. We go now to 1 Samuel 9, verses 17 through 19. When Samuel saw Saul, the Lord said to him, "Behold, the man of whom I spoke to you, this one shall rule over my people." Then Saul approached Samuel in the gate and said, "Please tell me where the seer's house is." So you see, Saul didn't recognize Samuel, which means that Samuel was not dressed up in any particular fashion to make him stand out. Samuel answered Saul and said, "I am the seer. Go up before me to the high place, for you shall eat with me today, and in the morning I will let you go and will tell you all that is on your mind." Of course, the purpose of Saul asking Saul to go to that meal, it was a ceremonial meal to honor the new king. Now, the Lord revealed to Samuel who the new king was. That revelation was probably confirmed by the fact that Saul was extraordinarily tall, and that's what kings were before then. So Samuel had confirmation. And remember, the day before, the Lord had told Saul the exact time Saul was going to come. "About this time tomorrow," in verse 16, "I will send you a man from the land of Benjamin." That's another way that Saul could have confirmed his choice was correct. The time of the arrival of Benjamin, and also he could have just asked, "Are you from the tribe of Benjamin?" "Yes, I'm from the tribe of Benjamin." Oh, there you go. That's three confirmations. The word of God, the height of Saul, and the tribe of Saul. Now, I said in verse 18 that Saul did not recognize Samuel because he had to ask him, "Are you the seer?" Well, Samuel was dressed ordinarily. He was unattended by servants, so he didn't know. Now, Samuel told Saul to go up to the high place before Samuel went. "Go up before me," which seems a little bit strange. Here you have a stranger going to a strange town. Is to go to the high place without Samuel accompanying him. Why was that? Maybe Samuel was old and couldn't keep up with the young Saul. Maybe Samuel had other business to attend to. Or maybe he wanted Saul to walk ahead of him to honor the future king of Israel, because the king would be going first. Now, that feast was in the evening, at the end of the day, but Saul wants Samuel to spend the night. In the morning, he was going to let him go the next morning. So that meant that Saul would have to spend the night with Samuel, which was good because Samuel could then deal with him, could talk to him. In fact, in verse 19, Samuel says, I'm going to tell you tomorrow morning all that is on your mind. Now, what would Samuel tell Saul? He would tell Saul why Saul came to the city, looking for a prophet who would tell him where to find his lost asses. Now, when Samuel told that to Saul, that would do what in Saul's mind? It would confirm to him, this man knows what he's talking about. He has a reputation for always speaking true prophecy in Israel. And this is just one more instance of it because he read my mail, like modern-day prophets like to say. He told me exactly why I'm here. Therefore, the word is confirmed. I know I will be king of Israel. Now, and Saul needed that because if you're a young guy with no prior political experience, from a small and despised tribe of Benjamin that had almost been wiped out because of its sins, because of the affair of the Levite's concubine, and all of a sudden you're told you're going to be king. Well, no, you need some confirmation of that. And Samuel knew that, and that's why he was saying, stay till tomorrow. I'm going to tell you things. I'm going to tell you what you're thinking. He doesn't say why he's going to do it, but we can infer reasonably the reason was is he wanted to buck Saul up. He wanted to make Saul know that the prophecy was true and that he was indeed going to be king. 1 Samuel 9:20-21, Samuel continues, As for your donkeys which were lost 3 days ago, do not set your mind on them, for they have been found. And for whom is all that is desirable in Israel? Is it not for you and for all your father's household? Saul replied, Am I not a Benjamite of the smallest of the tribes of Israel, and my family the least of all the families of the tribe of Benjamin? Why then do you speak to me in this way? So Saul's starting to think, this guy, you king, me? No. He's starting to express a little doubt. Well, the first thing that Samuel does is to take Saul's mind over off his lost asses. He's saying to Saul, hey, there's some other things that are bigger than lost asses that you need to be thinking about. And the fact that Samuel predicted that or revealed to Saul what Saul already knew, namely that his donkeys were lost 3 days ago, that revelation would tend to confirm Samuel's veracity in Saul's mind. Another thing that is done by Samuel telling Saul to not set his mind on the lost asses is it would keep Saul from wanting to get up and go looking for them. He wants Saul to be thinking about being king. He wants to get his mind off those lost asses. And then he says, hey, you and your father's household, you're going to get all this desirable. I guess he's assuming that being a king is desirable, although I have my questions about that. When you read the lives of most kings and queens throughout the history of Western civilization, well, not just Western civilization, Eastern civilizations also, like in China, you read the story and most kings and queens are miserable. But that's not the way Samuel put it. He gave a positive spin on it. He mentions not only Saul, but also his father's household is going to be receiving something that's desirable. Well, Saul's nephew Abner was made general of the army. That's a pretty high post. That could be what Samuel's referring to here. Now, Saul responds by saying, oh, I'm just a Benjamite, the smallest of the tribes. He's very humble now. Contrast that to the arrogance that Saul exhibited at the end of his career before he's killed by the Philistines. We go now to 1 Samuel 9:22-24. Then Samuel took Saul and his servant and brought them into the hall and gave them a place at the head of those who were invited, who were about 30 men. Samuel said to the cook, Bring the portion that I gave you, concerning which I said to you, set it aside. Then the cook took up the leg with what was on it and set it before Saul. And Samuel said, Here is what has been reserved. Set it before you and eat, because it has been kept for you until the appointed time, since I said I have invited the people. So Saul ate with Samuel that day. Now there was a hall there at the height of Ramah. That was a dining room of a house connected to the high place, we can speculate. Saul and his servant were invited at the head of the table, of course, the place of honor. Interesting that a slave, or at least a servant of Saul, would be invited to be put up there at the same place with Saul himself. Samuel said to the cook in verse 23, Bring the portion that I gave you. Now, if Samuel was operating as priest, he would have the right foreleg as well as the breast. And some people could speculate that Samuel was acting like a priest here. And he says, okay, this is my right foreleg. I want to give it to Saul. But the problem with that is a priest doesn't give a priest portion to a king or to anybody else. So I'm going to speculate it was the left foreleg of the sacrifice, whatever the sacrifice was. what was on the right foreleg was given to Saul, set before Saul. That could be the sauces on the meat. It could be the leg meat itself. The leg meat was on the leg. Some people speculate it was the breast meat, which is right next to the leg. If that's the case, then the Levitical proprieties were not being followed because a king's not supposed to eat the breast meat. So I just assume it's the leg meat set before Saul. Samuel says, here it is. This leg meat has been reserved for you. I got the cook to save it for you till you got here. Set it before you and eat because it has been kept for you until the appointed time. The appointed time meaning the time at the feast, which was where they were right then. Since I said I've invited the people, in other words, since the time that he told the people that they were invited, that would be the 30 people mentioned beforehand in verse 22. Again, I'm assuming they're elders of the city of Ramah. Jagiel speculates that it could be the people who were invited were Saul and the servants. Since I've invited the people, I think this is a stretch. Gil says that in the Eastern languages, two or three persons and even one are called a people. Well, no, it's probably the 30 men that were invited to the sacrifice. We move now to 1 Samuel 9, verses 25 through 27. When they, that's Saul and his servant, came down from the high place into the city, Samuel spoke with Saul on the roof. Well, that's they, Saul, the servant, and Samuel. And so Samuel spoke with Saul on the roof, and they arose early. This is the roof of Samuel's house in Ramah. And they arose early, and at daybreak Samuel called Saul on the roof, saying, get up, that I may send you away. So Saul arose, and both he and Samuel went into the street. As they were going down to the edge of the city, Samuel said to Saul, say to the servant that he might go ahead of us and pass on, but you remain standing now, that I may proclaim the word of God to you. Now when they came down from the high place into the city, Ramah was on a hill, but the high place was even higher. It's the highest place of the high city. Ramah means up on a hill. Samuel spoke with Saul on the roof. What would they speak about? Well, Saul could be telling Samuel about being made, or Samuel could be telling Saul about being made king by God. Samuel could be answering Saul's objections that he was from the smallest tribe, no big deal. Saul, it doesn't matter. He could be telling Saul how Saul could execute his office wisely and justly. Samuel could be telling Saul about Samuel's willingness to resign the government to Saul, because remember, Samuel's running the country right now. Why did they speak on the roof? Because the roof was often the favorite locality in the East for quiet conversation or rest, says Ellicott the commentator, and where frequently the honored guest was lodged for the night. Verse 26, Samuel says to Saul, get up. Of course, he was already up, because verse 26 says they arose early. I don't think you can take these time sequences that close at any rate, but it could, if you want to do that, you can say, well, he's already up from bed, but now Saul is saying, get up, get ready for your journey. Get up from sitting down, it's time to go. Samuel told Saul to send Saul's servant on ahead back home to Gibeah. Samuel didn't want the servant to see Samuel privately anointing Saul, because Saul was to eventually be chosen by public lot, and Samuel didn't want the servant to think Samuel was the one doing the choosing as opposed to the people. So, ladies and gentlemen, we have now finished 1 Samuel chapter 9. That prepares us for our next chapter, 1 Samuel 10, verses 1 through 27, and we will see Saul anointed king of Israel by Samuel. I hope you stay tuned for that audio, and I hope you enjoyed this one.